This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Wednesday, the National Hockey League Players Association and 62 agents who represent the players met in Chicago to discuss the union's latest proposal for a new collective bargaining agreement with the league. The union and the agents emerged from the six-hour meeting saying that they are united and urging National Hockey League owners to come back to the bargaining table. The two sides have not met since September 9th, 6 days before the lockout began. Scott Burnside is a freelance reporter in Atlanta who's currently covering the NHL lockout for ESPN.com, and he joins me now on the line from Atlanta. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. What specifically was discussed at that meeting on Wednesday?
Well, the meeting in Chicago on Wednesday was a further attempt by the National Hockey League Players Association to keep all of its constituents in line, really. It was really about telling agents where they felt negotiations were at, and, of course, negotiations being a relative term when you haven't spoken since September 9th, but really to uncover exactly what the league's position has been on a number of elements, to go over the league's last proposals, to explain in very fine detail exactly what the league is telling the players about what they're able to do in terms of negotiations. And part of the reason for doing that is that agents represent, of course, the rich and the poor in terms of players, and the feeling has been that maybe the Players Association had boxed themselves into a corner. And I think the meeting in Chicago was a way of keeping everyone in line and really keeping everyone on the same page in terms of the public relations battle in this lockout.
I gather the worry had been before the meeting that some players were beginning to get restless and say, hey, you know, I want to go back to work. Let's get something done, whatever the league offers.
Well, exactly. And really part of when you have a stalemate, as you do with the players and the owners, it really is about keeping the fractures from becoming too large and bringing down either side's house. And you're right, a lot of the players, because of the rank-and-file player, their average career may be 4 or 5 years. If you miss an entire season, you're looking at a quarter or 20% of your entire career earnings going down the tubes. And certainly the players are telling their agents that. Let's get back to the table. Why aren't we meeting? Why isn't there a deal? Maybe a salary cap isn't such a bad thing. And so as the Players Association did a couple of weeks ago in meeting with players, the player representatives from the various teams, they did the same with the agents to allay their fears and really to try and give them as much information as they could about what the league was proposing. And certainly the agents, when they left that meeting in Chicago, they were singing a very similar tune. They were marching in step with the union, which is critically important to the Players Association's position in this.
Now, does this announced solidarity convince the owners to abandon their insistence on a hard salary cap, or is this more likely to doom the already imperiled season?
I think that they're mutually exclusive. I don't think the meeting in Chicago really has any effect on what the owners are doing. The owner's position is as clearly entrenched as the player's position is, although it's interesting, an announcement late this week that Commissioner Gary Bettman and his executive would meet with general managers in New York on December 2nd. Now, whether that's an offshoot of the agents meeting with the Players Association, I'm not sure, but it certainly is another step in terms of keeping the owners' people in line and keeping them informed. So that will happen on December 2nd, and whether anything flows from that meeting, again, is anyone's guess.
In its most recent proposal, the Players Association offered revenue sharing, a luxury tax, a one-time 5% rollback of players' salaries. Most employers, I would think, would jump at an offer like that one. Why didn't the NHL owners accept that or at least make some sort of counteroffer to keep things going?
Well, you've hit on the sort of the nut of this dispute, is that you've got two sides. A lot of revenue, $1.2 billion in revenue last season, that should be able to be equitably distributed to keep both sides happy. But what you've got is two philosophical divides that appear not to be able to be crossed. And so when the players make a proposal, even if it is just a starting point, you're right. It appears to be logical that the owners would move to meet halfway. But instead, the owners are steadfastly stuck to having a salary cap of some kind. That is the problem, and Gary Bettman has promised his owners that, and that appears to be the line across which they will not step.
The National Hockey League has frequently cited the Leavitt Report, which the league itself commissioned. That report claims the league lost $479 million over the past two seasons. But the November 29th edition of Forbes magazine reports that the league lost about $219 million, less than half of what it claims. Which of these reports seems to you more accurate?
Well, the problem is that in both cases, perhaps neither of them are accurate, and that's why you see people looking at the two reports and saying, well, is the truth somewhere in the middle? That's the great issue. Why not bring in a third-party mediator to at least determine what are the real financial numbers? What's the real financial picture? And sadly, neither side appears ready to bring in anyone to try and help them mediate this.
Scott, make a prediction for us, if you can. What happens in the next few weeks? Is there any chance the sides will find something, anything, over which they can actually negotiate, or is it time to write off this professional hockey season altogether?
Well, that's what's interesting about the coming weeks, is a proposal and deal would have to be in place, I would think, no later than the middle of January, which leaves a lot of work to be done. So that drop-dead point is going to come very quickly. And the feeling is, if you have any optimism, is that faced with losing a season for the first time since 1919, when the influenza epidemic knocked out the NHL, that will be the time when perhaps players will say, okay, let's take a salary cap, or that conversely the owners will say, you know what, a luxury tax with teeth will actually achieve what we need to do in terms of reducing our costs. Whether that will happen, frankly, I don't have any optimism. Neither side has given any reason to believe that they will make any kind of movement. And I think, sadly, that this entire season will very quickly go by the boards.
Scott Burnside is a freelance reporter in Atlanta who's currently covering the National Hockey League lockout for ESPN.com. He joined me on the line from Atlanta. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
Sports labor strife currently extends beyond the rinks and onto racetracks in Kentucky, Indiana, and soon perhaps onto tracks in Florida, California, and elsewhere. Kathleen Adams has been following the boycotts, the bans, and the current insurance dispute between Churchill Downs and Hoosier Park officials and the jockeys who ride there. She has this report.
When jockeys at Churchill Downs began to talk seriously about boycotting the racetrack because of concerns over inadequate accident insurance, veteran rider Tony D'Amico wasn't privy to their discussions. That's because D'Amico was hospitalized at the time with injuries he sustained during a November 3rd spill at Churchill Downs. Those injuries include 6 broken ribs, a collapsed lung, and a shattered shoulder blade. Mindy D'Amico says it's unclear how long her husband will be away from the irons. But one thing is certain, insurance coverage provided by the track won't cover his bills.
When you first come in and realize you only have $100,000, everything goes through your mind. You're scared, you don't know what to do, but we'll get it done and then we'll worry about everything later. That's our attitude.
There are few within the industry who would argue against increasing catastrophic coverage for jockeys. The real issue is who will provide it. Albert Fiss is vice president of the Jockeys Guild, an organization which claims to represent over 1,200 riders. He was in the jockeys' room last week at Hoosier Park, which is also owned by Churchill Downs, when 15 jockeys shut down the Indiana facility by refusing to ride 10 minutes to post time. Fiss believes racetracks should pick up the tab for any additional insurance.
It's no different, quite frankly, than if you hire a plumber to come in and fix something in your kitchen and he gets injured. It's your homeowner's insurance that pays for that accident and the recovery of that independent contractor. Jockeys are being invited onto the racetrack, and the racetrack benefits from the job that they do.
Management at Churchill Downs disagrees with the comparison. John Asher, vice president of racing communications, says while the organization doesn't dispute that something should be done to improve existing coverage, it's wrong for jockeys to single out certain racetracks.
We feel it's an issue that deserves an industry-wide approach, industry-wide study, and an industry-wide response. It's not an issue that can be solved in a racetrack-by-racetrack basis.
Response to the boycotts has been swift. Last week, Churchill Downs and Hoosier Park each banned 14 jockeys who refuse mounts. In the case of Churchill Downs, Asher says the ban will hold until the end of the fall meet on November 27th.
In fairness to our owners, to our trainers, to our fans, not only here, but at satellite wagering outlets around the country, we had to give them assurances that our track would be running, that we could not go into every day with the prospect of riders walking out on us.
For those jockeys electing to ride, Churchill and Hoosier Park made available insurance policies that provide riders and their families with up to $5 million worth of medical coverage. Asher says monthly premiums range from $75 to $250. But Shane Sellers, who consistently ranked among the top riders at Churchill Downs and whose mounts have earned in excess of $100 million, says many jockeys can't afford those rates. Prior to the November 7th boycott, Sellers stopped riding, citing concerns over accident insurance. He says it's a misconception that all riders are millionaires.
Past the top 100 riders, on an average, riders make $29,000 a year. But everybody sees the Kentucky Derby, they see the Breeders' Cup. That's all you see on TV is the big races. There are many racetracks in the country that riders are starving to death.
Still, if you stand by Clocker's Tower on the backside of Churchill Downs, you'll find few trainers willing to express any sympathy for the riders. Chuck Simon speaks for many who feel the jockeys are holding the entire industry hostage.
I have horses to race, and this is a big meet. And we're going to run for a lot less money in the next 4 or 5 months. And we only have one more chance with some of these horses. And these owners' big chance to make their money and to pay for their bills for the year is at this meet, and it might be in the next, you know, coming weeks. And they didn't really care about that.
The National Thoroughbred Racing Association has assembled a 33-member task force to discuss accident insurance for jockeys. It convenes Monday at Turfway Park in Northern Kentucky. For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Louisville, Kentucky.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Never let it be said that Canadians don't take their football seriously. Some fans of the CFL Saskatchewan Rough Riders hurled eggs at the home of Paul McCallum, the Rough Riders kicker whose miss led to a playoff loss on Sunday. Another fan drove a dump truck to McCallum's house and left a load of manure on his neighbor's lawn. A third fan, fortunately given to talk rather than action, was arrested on Monday for threatening to burn down Paul McCallum's house. Rod Peterson, the sports director for CKRM, the radio station that broadcasts Rough Riders games, said of the perpetrators, "I think a lot of them are pretty normal 9-to-5 people, but when it comes to the riders, their brains fall on the floor." Perhaps as a result of that characterization, scores of fans sent McCallum so many flowers that the kicker had to ask them to stop because, quote, "My house is turning into a florist shop." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the game within a game when Yale visits Harvard. But first,
taking a long count here, he gives to Kenny. Kenny over the left side, touchdown! 74 yards on that drive, and Nebraska forges into the lead. Oh, man, woman, and child, I never thought I would live this long to see this kind of a football game.
On November 25th, 1971, Thanksgiving Day, the football teams from Nebraska and Oklahoma met in Norman, Oklahoma, and created what many fans and lots of the players involved came to consider the best college football game of the 20th century. Not surprisingly, Michael Corcoran's book about that game is entitled The Game of the Century. Michael Corcoran joins me now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Michael, welcome to Only a Game.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You make the point that Nebraska brought its own food along on the trip to Oklahoma. Was this rivalry really so intense that Nebraska head coach Bob Devaney thought his guys would be poisoned by Oklahoma cafeteria workers?
Well, I think that was paranoia in the extreme on Coach Devaney's part, but it is true. They did bring their own food.
The first exceptionally dramatic play in that game 34 years ago involved Nebraska's Johnny Rogers.
Rogers takes the ball at the 30. He's hit and got away. Back upfield to the 35, to the 40. He's to the 45. He's to the 50, to the 45, to the 40, to the 35, to the 20, to the 10. He's all the way home. Holy moly! Child did that. Put him in the aisle.
Rogers' 72-yard punt return for a touchdown was not an utterly unexpected event.
Well, he was a superb runner, and it was, in essence, turned out to be the most critical play of the game, although nobody could say that because there was only a few minutes gone in the game. But not unexpected. No, he was an incredible runner with the football, and I'd have to say that may be the single greatest run in football history.
Oklahoma brought into that game an offense with which they had scored 75 points against Kansas State a month earlier. What made Oklahoma's offense so hard to stop?
Well, it was probably the perfection of the wishbone offense, which at the time was still very new. By the 71 season, Oklahoma had brought it to its highest evolution. They just had the perfect people running it. And the quarterback, Jack Mildren, was just the perfect quarterback to run it because he was tough, and you need a tough quarterback to run the wishbone, and smart, and you need a smart quarterback to run the wishbone.
After Nebraska beat Oklahoma in the game of the century, both teams beat everybody else they played for the remainder of the season. If that hadn't happened, do you suppose that 1971 game would still be considered so exceptional?
Probably not. I mean, looking back, it has a lot to do with the fact that they ended up 1-2 in the country, that Nebraska was the national champion for the second year in a row. So it's important the way the season ended up to look back at the game. If they hadn't, I think it still would be considered one of the very best games, but the fact that they ended up that way ensured it.
One of the things that struck me reading your book was how much fun all the guys that played in that game, whether they were playing for Nebraska or Oklahoma, how they seemed to enjoy recalling the game. They just all seemed to be very proud of the fact that they were there on that afternoon.
It's interesting. Yeah, they do have a lot of fun. And a lot of them said that initially they didn't want to think about it, but as years have gone by, they realize how lucky they've been to play in that game. And occasionally somebody will come up to them and say, "Hey, you played in that game. You played in that great game." And then it strikes them then. They realize how lucky they were to play in it. And everyone I talked to, it really enjoyed looking back on it. Even, in fact, the guys from Oklahoma who lost the game seemed a little more happy to talk about than the guys from Nebraska did.
So you didn't run into anybody who said, "Yeah, that was kind of the highlight of my life, and now 30 years have gone by."
It is interesting, not in the sort of glory days kind of way that the question might suggest, but there are guys. John Harrison was the big star of the game for Oklahoma, really. Unexpectedly caught several huge passes because Oklahoma didn't throw the ball at all, really. And he said that, you know, he still looks back now in his life when he thinks about things. It's not about the big games he won. It's about the big games he lost. And the Texas High School State Championship 4 years earlier were the two big games that he lost in his life.
Michael Corcoran is the author of The Game of the Century, Nebraska versus Oklahoma in College Football's Ultimate Battle, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
A little later on today, Yale and Harvard will play a game of football at Soldiers Field in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Though the game will have no bearing on who'll go to which postseason bowl or which universities trailing in the wake of their teams will gross millions in TV revenues, today's contest will not be without significance. Harvard, undefeated this season, is poised to claim the Ivy League championship. Yale, oft defeated, would derive considerable satisfaction from derailing that plan. And the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, well, history suggests that some group of intrepid, creative, and mechanically inclined MIT students might conspire to create, against the backdrop of this afternoon's game, an entertaining diversion. In fact, according to Bernie Corbett, the author of a recent history of the Yale-Harvard rivalry entitled "The Only Game That Matters," it would be no exaggeration to say that sometimes what the students from MIT have managed to do during the Yale-Harvard football game has been more interesting than the game itself.
Well, I think that the one in particular from 1982 would not be an overstatement because of the fact that it was a 45-7 blowout and really wasn't much of a football game. But leave it to the boys from MIT to attract network notoriety, specifically confusing the heck out of Brent Musburger at CBS
Early in the second half, the befuddled Mr. Musburger, who was doing the play-by-play of the aforementioned game, told a national audience that a bomb had floated down out of the stands and exploded to create a 3-foot crater in the middle of the field. He was mistaken. In fact, a modest explosive charge under the field had pushed through the turf an ingenious device made of wires, some old vacuum cleaner parts, the points from a 1967 Mustang, and a lot of duct tape. The rocket-shaped machine inflated at field level a black weather balloon, thoroughly festooned with the initials MIT. According to Debbie Douglas, the curator of science and technology at the MIT Museum, where the apparatus that launched and inflated the balloon is on display, the prank, which MIT students call a hack, was the culmination of hundreds of hours of planning, construction, and more.
This event involved reconnaissance. They figured out what the Harvard police schedule was for surveillance, and they learned the timing of the searchlights that would pass over the field.
It's like breaking out of jail.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it was an enormous effort. They even practiced. They buried it in a field the winter before so they could test to make sure it worked under cold conditions. This was a long planned for and much hoped for hack.
It was also a magnificently unlikely and brilliantly successful enterprise. Consider that the perpetrators, who turned out to be a group of students belonging to the Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity at MIT, had to dig and then conceal a trench in Harvard's field and run wires under the field and into the stadium itself, where there was a power source. And then, when the deal didn't go down precisely according to schedule, one of the students had to go down into the bowels of the stadium to manually throw the switch that triggered the balloon inflating device. When the sod broke and the balloon began to reveal itself, nobody was more surprised than Pat Rui, the offensive lineman who captained the Yale football team in 1982.
I was probably the person closest to the most spectacular stunt of all.
Dr. Pat Rui, an orthopedist, is now the team physician for Yale's football program.
We were on the kickoff receiving team, and I was on the far right side of the front line of the receiving team. And we were standing there getting ready for the kickoff, and there was a small kind of explosion off to my right. And I looked over, and it was almost like a worm crawling out of the sod of the stadium and a bunch of smoke.
Pretty scary, eh? And then it got scarier.
And then it started to grow. And by that point, we were all kind of backpedaling and giving this thing some space, and nobody knew what in the world it was. And this thing just blew up into this enormous, I think it was a black balloon with MIT written all over it.
How big does it seem to have been?
Maybe 6 to 8 feet in diameter, something like that.
Well, because some people now remember it as big as a house.
Oh, no. If it was as big as a house, it would have taken me with it. But it was certainly big enough to get our attention, I can tell you that.
Big enough to get a lot of people's attention. Big enough, as we've heard, to trigger in Brent Musburger lurid fantasies of carnage and devastation. But in fact, since one of the unwritten rules of hacking at MIT is that there should be no damage, the balloon conveniently and harmlessly exploded into nothing, and attached to the mechanism that had launched the orb was a neatly written set of instructions for repairing the sod. According to MIT Museum curator Debbie Douglas, that was a process the hackers had learned to understand.
When they carved out the piece of turf, one of their greatest fears was that the grass would die, and it would leave a telltale brown spot on the field. They implanted it the Tuesday before the game, but there were nightly missions to water that plot of grass to keep it alive.
8 years later, a group of MIT students once again managed to infiltrate Soldier's Field for some mechanical mischief. This time, they interrupted a Yale field goal attempt with a small remote-controlled rocket that burst from one of the goalposts, trailing a banner that read MIT. Joe Ristic coached the Harvard team in both the 1982 and the 1990 games. By the time of the second hack, the MIT students had taught Coach Ristic to expect the unexpected and not to try to deter its perpetrators.
The minute you think that you have to do something to put a stop to it, it's going to happen. It's going to happen again and again. That's what makes it so unique. You never know. Now, this year, you never know what will happen. It could be anything.
At MIT this week, none of the students who were speaking would admit that they knew about any plan to interrupt Saturday's game, though numbers of them seemed preoccupied with a story about a hack involving birdseed, whistles, and referees.
They got together with the birds or something, and they wore referees' uniforms as they were coming back from Harvard.
And you just blow a whistle, wear a ref uniform, and throw out seeds, and all these birds started coming eventually. And so then the time the game came,
the referees came out and they were blowing their whistles, and so the birds came and blocked the field.
And covered the field.
Yeah, we've heard this one a bunch of times. I love this. I wonder if it ever happened.
I think it's real. I don't think that they, like, make these stories up.
In fact, there is no record of hungry pigeons being conditioned to envelop a Yale-Harvard game, no day upon which the game was fouled up by foul. But we didn't tell any of the students at MIT that. Why ruin a good story? And, of course, the more important story this afternoon is supposed to be the football game. Despite the fact that Harvard is a heavy favorite, at least one veteran of a quarter century's worth of these games, Dr. Pat Rui, says an upset is not out of the question.
I think there's precedent for it. There's been several times over the years that one team's come in undefeated and the other team has been having a bit of a rough year, and you just never know what's going to happen. You never know what kind of forces are in play, what kind of effort the kids are going to bring to the table, and you never know what MIT is going to do as well, I guess. So throw all the factors up in the air, and it should be a good game.
Ordinarily, given the records of the two teams to this point, I might say that kind of talk was a lot of horse feathers. I might maintain that Dr. Rui's prediction of a genuinely interesting game this afternoon was for the birds, but that might be asking for trouble.
We have the technology, not available before. We have the technology. We have the technology. Technology.
You're listening to Only a Game. The aforementioned Yale-Harvard contest is known as the game, at least to people who went to Yale or Harvard. Intriguingly, Oklahoma-Texas is also known as the game. More delightfully, the Oklahoma-Oklahoma State game is known as the Bedlam game, and Oregon versus Oregon State bills itself as the Civil War. Many of the top football rivalries in the college game feature distinctive trophies, some of them grim indeed. California plays Stanford for the Stanford Axe, while Minnesota and Wisconsin play for Paul Bunyan's Axe. Northwest Missouri State battles Truman State for the Hickory Stick. Notre Dame takes on Purdue for the Shillelagh Trophy. And then Notre Dame plays USC for the Jeweled Shillelagh, which must make Purdue feel kind of second rate. Boston College and Notre Dame play for the Ireland Trophy, which is probably a shillelagh as well. There are more weapons on some trophy shelves, or at least there once were. Arizona used to play New Mexico State for the Kit Carson Rifle, but that rivalry is now defunct, not, I hope, for any reason having to do with the discharging of the Kit Carson Rifle. Nevada and the University of Nevada at Las Vegas up the ante by playing for the Fremont Cannon. Weirdly, given all these clubs, axes, and guns serving as trophies, the players on the winning team when Army and Navy go at it get only gold stars to put on their letter sweaters. Bowling Green and Toledo go the service academies one better by playing for the peace pipe. Meanwhile, Brigham Young University and Utah State play for the old wagon wheel. Dickinson battles Franklin and Marshall for the Conestoga Wagon Trophy. Akron plays Kent for the wagon wheel, not to be confused with the old wagon wheel, and then battles Youngstown State for the steel tire, while UC Davis faces off against Sacramento State for the whole package, the victory carriage. Vessels also make popular trophies. Houston plays Rice for the Bayou Bucket. Dickinson battles Gettysburg for the Oaken Bucket. Michigan and Minnesota contend for the Little Brown Jug. Appalachian State plays Western Carolina for the Old Mountain Jug. And the Coast Guard Academy annually battles Rensselaer for the Shot Glass. Now there's a tradition. Animal lovers will either be delighted or dismayed to learn that Carleton College and St. Olaf annually contend for the Goat Trophy, while Montana plays Montana State for the Grizzly Bobcat Painting. Finally, perhaps most pointlessly, LSU and Tulane beat each other up each fall for a trophy known as the Rag. This is allegedly a flag with the colors of both schools on it, although nobody knows for certain because the Rag went missing years ago, and each school claims that the other one has it. Maybe LSU and Tulane should play instead for a carriage or a cannon, which would be harder to misplace. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, turkey tenderizing and other pre-Thanksgiving foul play. But first, a look at the week's news with Charlie Pierce, a.k.a. Mr. NASCAR. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
NASCAR's new 10-man, 10-race playoff system has created an intriguing set of possibilities going into tomorrow's season-ending race in Homestead, Florida. Who do you like to take the cup?
Well, I think Jimmy Johnson's going to hang on and actually do it, although there are five people bunched within 82 points of each other. This is the closest Nextel, well, obviously the closest Nextel Cup championship ever since it's only been the
Numero
Nextel
uno.
Cup for 1 year. But there were a lot of complaints among my my more devoted NASCAR subjects about gussying this whole thing up to make it work more like a conventional American sport, but that's where NASCAR has been heading for 10 years anyway. I think Jimmy Johnson hangs on and puts the Nextel Cup over his head.
Longtime Nike CEO and President Phil Knight announced Thursday that he will relinquish those titles next month. I will wait to hear your take on this after the wails of shareholders and the high-pitched cheers of international laborers have subsided.
Sweatshop. I'm sorry. Does it really matter that he's not going to be CEO? He's just going to be chairman? Do you know, by the way, in 1971, he paid somebody $35 to design the swoosh?
And the guy didn't retain the
a
rights.
Lady, please. Let's not be ridiculous here.
She didn't retain the rights, did she?
No, no, she gave it away. But
it was gone for $35.
Let's admit the company never would have stayed the same if it had remained Blue Ribbon Sports, Inc.
I'd have to agree with you there. The college basketball season is upon us again. Which teams, men's and women's, will you be watching from now until March?
Well, I think that, gee, guess what, Bill? Guess who's number one in women's basketball? Two guesses.
Tennessee. Connecticut, Tennessee. Tennessee.
The one with the T. There we go. Yeah, Tennessee is ranked number one. LSU and Texas both ranking ahead of Connecticut, however.
There you go.
Which is obviously building. I think with women's basketball, you will have the usual suspects with the possible interloper of the Baylor Bears, mm-hmm. who are ranked in the top 10 this year and will be a fine team. On the men's side, it's almost the same thing, except Wake Forest is a better team than people thought. They beat George Washington, who's also a pretty good team, 97-76. Syracuse got a good win on Thursday night over Mississippi State in Madison Square Garden. Those are the two best wins of the early season so far.
Perhaps the most lurid, allegedly sports question of the week involves ABC's promotion of the program Desperate Housewives, Charlie, before the Monday night football game. This was a promotion in which one of the stars of the sitcom, Nicolette Sheridan, convinced Eagles receiver Terrell Owens to play something other than football. Are we looking at Janet Jackson, too, here?
Unfortunately, we are, and the sports and politics and the climate and, of course, the red state people, wadi-doo-da, are going to force us to not have a sense of humor about this. I found it hilarious that this became such a blazing issue on sports talk radio, that bastion of cheap political slander, leering sexual innuendo, third-rate gay baiting, and all-around indecency, and suddenly these are the gentlemen who are leaping on the what about the children bandwagon? What about shutting up?
Meanwhile, on the field, a quarterback named Manning is at the center of a controversy of sorts in New York. What's that all about?
Well, usually you change quarterbacks and go to the promising rookie when your team is 1-8 or something like that. The Giants are 5-4, and Tom Coughlin's pulled the trigger to remove Kurt Warner, who's having a pretty good season, and try Eli Manning. There's a lot of buzz in New York about why this is going on. The general manager seems unclear about it, although, you know, this was something that was going to happen sooner or later. It's happening sooner because the Giants, frankly, started off 4-1 and are now 5-4, and they've lost to teams like Detroit and Arizona. you know, this has persuaded Tom Coughlin, who's never a man to sit around in a situation where panic is required, to change quarterbacks.
In further pro football action, it was revealed this week that 64 car dealers are participating in a program that gives 85 free cars to the coaches and athletic department staff at Ohio State University. Should Ohio State be proud of that figure or embarrassed
by
it?
Well, according to the NCAA, it's perfectly fine to give cars to coaches, assistants, sports department workers, the wives of coaches, and the athletic director.
85 cars!
85 cars! There are a lot of assistant coaches, and a lot of them have a lot of wives,
that's right.
I'll bet.
The Oklahoma-Nebraska game last weekend featured, among other things, an apparent assault by a Nebraska player on an Oklahoma rooter and the Nebraska coach calling the Oklahoma fans bleeping hillbillies. Good, clean fun. Good, clean fun of a Saturday afternoon.
Well, there are those of us who are old enough to remember when this was the real rivalry in college football, instead of having been shuffled into the beginning of November so television could put Nebraska and Colorado on Thanksgiving weekend. A Nebraska football player rammed a member of the OU Roughnecks, spelled, by the way, if you're spelling at home, RUF/NEKS.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder about that, whether or not there's more than a little like
the
a truth in that
hillbilly
thing. But, you know, the ridiculous thing about what the Nebraska coach said, of course, is there are no hills in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma head coach Bob Stoops indicated this week that he felt that ESPN was underrating his team for reasons that have nothing to do with the team's performance on the field. Should we take this charge seriously?
No, of course not. This is a coach whining about the media. Listen, I've seen Oklahoma play, and I've seen Auburn play. Auburn's a better team. If Auburn wins out and USC wins out, they play for the national championship. And Bob Stoops, if he's really concerned, can give back all the money ESPN pays the school for putting its sorry football and basketball games on television.
The New York State Athletic Commission indefinitely suspended Evander Holyfield this week, Charlie, citing, quote, poor performance after his loss to the immortal Larry Donald last Saturday. Any chance that this suspension will stick and that, in fact, Holyfield will be prevented from fighting again?
Oh, God, I hope so. Evander Holyfield is done. Evander Holyfield is one very, very innocuous punch away from being seriously injured. I don't envy the conscience of anybody who puts him in a ring again or even fights this decision. He should walk away.
On Wednesday night, the Seattle Supersonics and the New Jersey Nets played a game bad enough to nearly empty the arena in New Jersey before it was over. How often does a team end up with more fouls than field goals?
Not very often at all. The Sonics started the first half 0 for 10, the second half 0 for 8, won the game anyway. By the way, the Nets had more fouls than field goals at 29 to 26 and came very close to having more turnovers than field goals.
Excellent.
Which would have been very ugly. They had 23 turnovers and 26 field goals.
Vince Carter of the Toronto Raptors will have to discover another way to find his focus before basketball games. Charlie, the NBA says that he can't listen to music on his iPod during warm-ups anymore. Why not? Product placement issue there?
Hello, Bill. This is Dr. Naismith. This is a problem I did not anticipate when I invented this game. Actually, the way they got him to not listen to his iPod during the warm-up is to say that it's a violation of the uniform rules. There's nothing in the uniform about wearing anything on your head. Or in your ears, which is where I would tell the NBA to put their uniform rules.
There you go. Images of Red Sox outfielder Johnny Damon have appeared on lampposts in Brooklyn this week, which borough president Marty Markowitz has said will be scrubbed clean very soon. I wonder if graffiti associated with the Yankees or the Mets would have provoked similar dismay.
Marty Markowitz is another guy, like the people who are angry at ABC, who need to have a large, tall, cool glass of get over it. I think just with a little bit of tapering of the picture, you can claim that this is a religious icon.
Absolutely.
You know, if this picture turned up on somebody's wallpaper in Oklahoma, you'd have people driving there and paying money to see it.
And selling it on eBay.
That's
before. Or you could turn around, absolutely. Finally, Charlie, a fine has been levied upon a woman who bungled the Mexican national anthem before an October 30th soccer match. Any truth to the rumor that the unfortunate woman's name is Rosanna Barrio?
No. The woman's name is even better. It's Guadalupe Madrigal.
And Madrigal, she
would have been better off singing in Madrigal. She can be fined $808 American under Mexican law for somehow defacing the national anthem by forgetting the words. Let us point out, by the way, if this law was in effect here, Carl Lewis would still be doing time.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
We'll be right back. Steve O'Neill, a listener in Duluth, Minnesota, emailed us this week to say that he'd enjoyed last week's story about Christopher Swain's wet and muddy adventure. The story on the Charles River swim/cleanup really hit me, he wrote. We have our dirty St. Louis River here and the Mississippi close by. My hometown of Chicago has the Chicago, Fox, and Calumet filthy streams. Mr. O'Neill didn't exactly invite Christopher Swain to swim the lengths of those five waterways, but his intent seems clear, doesn't it? Carol J. Thompson, a WBUR listener, also enjoyed the story about Christopher Swain. It's Monday morning now, she wrote, and by the magic of the computer, I get to hear the good news over and over again. Thanks for sharing it, and so many other stories. In the light of all the ugly and discouraging news, this story brings sunlight to my heart. I'm delighted to update a story we told a couple of years ago. Steve Zirik, the commissioner of the International Rutabaga Curling Federation, wrote this week to assure us that the Federation's 2004 Rutabaga Curl will occur at the Farmers Market in Ithaca, New York, on December the 18th. Remarkably, Commissioner Steve expects appearances not only from the Canadian and Scottish national teams, but from the Vatican Rutabaga Curling team as well. Sandra Kersey, a listener who lives in Boston, wrote this week to say, I love your show. I play it for my clients while I'm giving them facials. I usually play classical music, but I love your show so much, I listen to it, and my clients really like it, too. And finally, Sonia Klemperer-Johnson, who recently returned to the East Coast from 5 years in California, also emailed this week, I lived in Boston 5 years ago, she wrote, and listened to your show as I drove to work Saturday mornings. One recent morning, driving to New York City, I happened upon Only a Game and was struck by the familiar-sounding voice. Now I make sure to be awake, maybe not out of bed, by 7 on Saturday to hear your wonderful show. I'm glad it's still on the air. Sonia, so am I. Should you wish to contact us, our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can also reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. News from Athens this week indicates that the bill for the Summer Olympics may go as high as $15 billion, well over twice the original estimate. Mandy Liley, who will be coordinating the first annual Turkey Olympics on Thanksgiving Day, does not anticipate a similar cost overrun. Ms. Liley is the business manager of the Icon Center, home of the University of Wyoming hockey team. She joins me now from Cheyenne. Mandy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks.
Tell me what the Turkey Olympics are.
Actually, it's ice games that we're going to do for the public, mainly for the youth of the town. It involves lots of zany games and lots of fun competitions and prizes, and just basically let some steam off and do something other than just skating around in circles on the ice arena we have here.
Well, describe some of the allegedly zany games for me.
Okay, we have turkey bowling, which will head up tonight. We take a frozen turkey and we get out on the ice and we bowl at bowling pins. Then after that, we've got several games. We have Olympic-class games. We're doing turkey shot put, and we're doing turkey curling.
That seems like a natural. Yeah, that's a natural. That's easy.
Yeah, and one of our favorite games that we're going to be doing that night is turkey bareback riding.
Turkey bareback riding? Do the turkeys ride, or are they ridden?
They are ridden. And actually, unlike it sounds, they're not live turkeys.
No bird will be injured during the performance of this trick.
That's right. It's a team event, and one person pushes another person on a turkey.
Oh.
And after a certain point, they have to let go, and it's the first person to cross the line without falling off.
Tell me a little bit more about the process. Who was the originator of this idea, or is nobody willing to take responsibility for that?
At this point, I'm not sure that any one person wants to take responsibility. Like I said, it was something my GM and I were sitting there late one night trying to come up with a special event. We'd heard about turkey bowling, and we just decided to expand on it.
Are you worried at all that despite the fact that these turkeys are frozen and therefore will feel no pain, that there'll be any objection to this animal grounds or something like that?
We're really really not too concerned with that. We'd be more concerned if we were, going out and getting turkeys killed for the event. We're just going to the local grocery store and buying the biggest turkeys we can find.
And is there a sense of excitement in town? Has this been publicized to the degree that people know it's coming and they're anticipating, you know, this as being a big evening?
Yes, we just started advertising it on the local radio and putting up posters and flyers, and we're getting quite a bit of interest, the same kind of interest of people going, what is that? What are we supposed to do? So, you know, once in a while, you just got to have some fun.
Now, in terms of preparation, how many turkeys and other feathered animals, frozen feathered animals, are you going to need for this event?
We're probably looking at doing upwards of 20 to 25.
And in the aftermath of the carnage, who cleans it up? And have you got a special, like a giblet Zamboni or something to pick up the parts?
We do not. That is going to be one of those things that we'll have to approach when we get to it. Any turkeys that are in one piece at the end of it will be donating to the local homeless shelter.
And then there's the question of whether anybody at the homeless shelter wants to eat a turkey that somebody's been riding or beating on with a stick.
I have never myself had to eat a turkey that's been thrown at bowling pins or, you know, ridden. So I'm not quite sure how that's going to come out.
It's kind of an experiment in every possible phase of this event, isn't it?
Exactly. We pride ourselves in thinking outside the box, I guess. So.
Well, that's great, because I've got to wonder if this goes as well as I assume that it will. Do you expand the event next year to include mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, cranberry sauce, things of that nature?
Who knows? Who knows? We're planning on hopefully doing this as an annual event. This will be our first year, and who knows what we'll come up with next year.
Well, football has been traditionally the sport most closely associated with Thanksgiving. I wonder if your adventures on the hockey rink with the frozen turkeys will change all that.
We can only hope.
Mandy Liley is the business manager for the Icon Center in Cheyenne, Wyoming, the birthplace of the Turkey Olympics. Mandy, thank you very much, and good luck, especially with the cleanup.
We may need it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Hertzfeld at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from an anonymous MIT student eager to help me find those students who might hack today's game between Harvard and Yale.
Go further that way. That's East Campus. They all live over there.
And that's about as close as Only a Game is going to come to investigative journalism. 60 minutes is safe, I think. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.